Hello and welcome to the Squawker Talker Euro 2020 Group F Preview Podcast. The group of death, Portugal, Germany and France, all paired in together. But before we get on to some of the big heavyweights, we are starting off with Hungary, down as team number one, thanks to UEFA. And I'm joined by Hungarian football expert Tomas Mortimer. Now, before we get into the squad, we need to talk about the group of death, as it's been baptised by the media, by supporters, probably even by UEFA when they were drawing out the balls for Euro 2020. Given the fact that on paper this looks like a real, real tall order for Hungary, how is the mood from Hungarian fans ahead of the tournament?
I think most people are just really excited, to be honest. It's only the second tournament Hungary have actually qualified for in 35 years. Five being, obviously, would have been four if it had been Euro 2020. So I think it's just more excitement. Like the last Euros that we had in 2016 was like super enjoyable, and Hungary exceeded expectations massively, to be honest. I think most people kind of expected them to finish bottom of that group and got through to the last 16 and drew to eventual winners Portugal. This time, with games being in Hungary and the group being announced, playing three of the best teams in, well, the World Cup winners, the Euros winners and Germany. I think there's half of the personalities and the people of Hungary are kind of thinking, oh my God, this is going to be awful. And then the other half is kind of thinking, oh, this is just going to be really, really exciting. So I think you couldn't have asked for a better group in some ways, and then you couldn't have asked for a worse group in others. So, yeah, I think it's mixed feelings, but a lot of excitement.
And in terms of manager, Marco Rossi has come into the team. He's been in charge for the bulk of Euro 2020 qualifying. But based on the results going into the tournament, Hungary fall into that block of teams that, had it been last summer as originally scheduled, there had probably been less positivity surrounding the team, because qualification was a bit of a disaster. Finishing in fourth place in behind Croatia, Wales and Slovakia, it was actually the Nations League in 18-19 that got you a playoff spot. Some positivity, obviously, to get through. Big last gasp 2-1 win over Iceland. But the surrounding form going into that was pretty poor. This delay of 12 months has allowed Rossi to kind of galvanise his players and get things back together. Three wins and one defeat from the Nations League at the back of 2020. And then you've started World Cup qualification in 2021 with some real positivity, three games unbeaten and an impressive 3-3 draw against Poland.
Yeah, so Rossi took over a team which was in all sorts of trouble, to be honest. After Euro 2016, Hungary started the next World Cup qualifying for 2018 in shocking form. Like, they drew to Faroe Islands, ended up losing in that qualifying campaign to Andorra. So, like, it couldn't have got any worse. No one loses to Andorra, and Hungary managed to do that. So when he came in, he was picking up a team which were at the bottom. So Euros was kind of, there was no expectations really. It was in a tough group. Obviously, Croatia had just made the World Cup final. And Slovakia are decent. Wales, we know, are decent. So kind of Hungary went into the last game of the group. Actually, if they'd have beaten Wales, they would have qualified for the Euro straight away. They ended up losing to Wales that night, playing pretty poorly, actually. And then ended up finishing fourth. But thanks to the ludicrous way that the Nations League is set out, they obviously did get a chance to atone for that. And I mean, two games to qualify for the tournament, playing Bulgaria, and Bulgaria are really bad in that game, and they're not a great side, and then to play Iceland in a winner takes all, it kind of does cheapen qualification in many ways. But I think it's kind of where Hungary have come from World Cup qualification. It's pretty impressive turnaround, really. To even be kind of close to qualifying through the group was reasonably impressive. And like you say, in back end of 2020, Hungary played Bulgaria, beat them easily, and they played all those Nations League games in Group B, Turkey, Russia, Serbia, and ended up winning the group out of those four teams. So that was impressive. And then beating Iceland in the final day, in the Nations League playoff was like spectacular. Hungary were actually pretty poor against Iceland, and Iceland are really stubborn opponents. And it took an 87th minute equaliser from Loic Nego and an absolute wonder goal from Dominik Szoboszlai to take Hungary there. And Hungary were in a very good moment before that game, and there was expectations I get going into it were maybe, yeah, I think we'll win. We think we'll win this. Positivity was at an all-time high, and that's just carried on into this year. Like you say, the three games that we've played so far, well, two of them were against Andorra and San Marino, so you expect to win those. But against Poland, Hungary were fantastic, and it was really disappointing to draw that game because Hungary were 2-0 up and cruising, to be honest. It was as good as I'd seen Hungary play in a long time, in about 20 years, or probably longer, probably as long as I've been watching Hungary. So to draw that game was really disappointing in the end, but it just shows, I think, how far Hungary have come under Marco Rossi and the positivity that they can take into the tournament as well, despite the tough teams that they are going to play against.
And looking at the team and who's expected to be starting, for Rossi, the majority of particularly his first 11 picks itself based on the World Cup qualifiers. And there's a running RB Leipzig theme right the way through, from goalkeeper to defence, right the way through to attack. And given the fact that you're coming up against Portugal, France, Germany, some of the superstars in their attack, Kylian Mbappe, Cristiano Ronaldo, Timo Werner, defence is going to be absolutely vital for Hungary to ensure that they've got something to build on in these group games. And Peter Gulacsi and Willy Orban know each other inside out from Leipzig. Orban's played the entire season in front of him. They've both been really important for Leipzig for the last few seasons. And given the fact that that is in reality going to be the key to how Hungary survive in this group, making sure they don't get battered, making sure they can keep the ball out of the net, how important are those two, and particularly Orban as a leader, to make sure that the players around him don't kind of crack under the pressure of some of these amazing players they're going to be marking?
Yeah, for sure. It's massively important. And Hungary have a real history since kind of communism fell at the end of the 80s of having really, really brittle defences. Like, we've had some quite exciting attacking players down the years, but defensively, we've really, really struggled. We've just not been able to produce a centre-half. We've had Roland Juhasz and then very little else. So Hungary now are in a really good position, actually, defensively. I think that also helps because Marco Rossi has brought almost like the stereotypical Italian mentality in terms of defence. And another reason for that, like you say, is Willy Orban, who, without him, I think the defence would be good, but it would be nowhere near as good as it is right now. It, like you say, his leadership is important more than anything, but he's just his defensive ability is so important. He's a defender first, which we don't always see these days. Like, you see players who are really, really good on the ball at centre-half, and I think to someone like Martin Dada, who's a Hungarian German who's playing in the Bundesliga, who is excellent on the ball. But what Hungary needed more than anything was a defender first, and that's exactly what he is. And there is no coincidence that Hungarian defensively have got so much better with him and Gulacsi there. And also we've got a youngster called Attila Szalai, who's at Fenerbahce, who's being linked to English clubs all the time at the moment, I think for about 25 million. So to have him in there alongside Orban, like, Szalai is superb on the ball as well, like a hell of a left foot. So it really complements nicely. Hungary play with a back three. So there is kind of another one who's going to fit alongside those two, who is of a lesser quality. It's probably going to be likely to be Adam Long from Ammonia Nicosia in Cyprus, or Attila Fiola. So, like, there's two very good centre-halves. We've got an excellent goalkeeper who hasn't performed that well for Hungary, to be honest, especially compared to someone like Gábor Király, who was almost like a laughable figure around most of Europe, but he was fantastic for Hungary. Gulacsi has just not lived up to his ability. Like, I see people talk about him as being one of Europe's best goalkeepers, and I think he was one of the best goalkeepers in Bundesliga this year and last year. But for some reason, he just can't really translate that to the Hungarian national team. But I think the confidence that Orban has, like you say, more than anything, has just really elevated this Hungarian defence to a level that we've not seen for ages.
And looking front foot forward, you mentioned it before, Dominik Szoboszlai is massively, massively highly rated. He's been linked with moves away from, again, Leipzig, continuing the theme, because he's been so important for them after his move from RB Salzburg last season. Given the fact that there is going to be a lot of attention on him and Hungary are in a position where it will have to be defence first, Szoboszlai, we know he's very, very creative. He can score a goal and he can just drag a moment of magic out of nothing. You look at the rest of this Hungary squad, there's a lot of solid experience in midfield and in attacking areas. Someone like Szoboszlai can provide that spark that is going to be needed if it's 60, 70 minutes of solid defending.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a kind of a problem with Szoboszlai at the moment because he hasn't played for a long time, and it seemed like he was going to be back in April and he wasn't back in April. It seemed like he was going to be back for the last few games of this Leipzig season and he wasn't back for the last few games of the Leipzig season. And it's kind of, what Szoboszlai are we going to get from him in the Euros? We've seen it with, I guess, Wayne Rooney is a really good example for the 2010 World Cup. He got injured in the lead-up. I think he did his metatarsal. And then he was a shock. It was just a shell of himself at the Euros, at the World Cup, sorry. I think a lot of Hungarians are a little bit scared of what type of Szoboszlai will come back. Hungary did very well without him when they played against Poland in that 3-3 draw. And there's probably some people out there who think if he's going to be a 25%, 50% fit, we'd rather not have him. And then there'd be the other people who would say, well, whatever type of Szoboszlai we get, we'd rather have him in the team. So it's going to be a really difficult one. I'm hoping that he plays potentially on Saturday or on Sunday, sorry, for Leipzig, or is on the bench. That'll be a real big boost. Or he is back fully fit for the two friendly games before the tournament. Because if he's going into the Portugal game in the opener and he's not fully fit, I think that is going to be a real, real blow for Hungary. Like the midfield three is, like I say, did really well against Poland. But Zsolt Kalmár was one of the players who played in that game, and Zsolt Kalmár is also out of the tournament. So that's a huge blow. Szoboszlai would be the person to replace Kalmár in that midfield. But now it's going to be Daniel Gosdag, if not, and he's at Philadelphia Union. He's never actually played for them. He's only just moved from Hungary. He's never played outside of the Hungarian league. So the difference between Gosdag and Szoboszlai is obviously huge. So we really, really need Szoboszlai. Hungary, like I say, defensively are very, very good, better than they've ever been since becoming like an independent nation. And going forward, there are very few goals. You look at, if you went onto the Hungarian national team on Wikipedia and looked at their goal scoring record, then you will not be impressed. I think it's only Adam Zolai who has double figures. Nemanja Nikolic is reasonably close. And the third top scorer in the squad is Willy Orban, who's obviously a defender we've just spoken about. So we need that spark from Szoboszlai in there, because we will just be so blunt. If we go 1-0 down back, but to any of those teams, we're going to really, really struggle if we don't have Szoboszlai. Adam Zolai is a decent striker. Roland Szalai is a decent player, but they're not goal scorers. And Szoboszlai is the type of man who will help from open play and from set pieces. So, he's so, so vital for the creativity of this team. But along with the creativity, he's also defensively very, very good for an attacking midfielder. So he's the whole package if he's fit, but it's a big if at the moment.
Looking at the group, obviously, as we said, issues in terms of the sheer strength of the other teams in it. And you look at Hungary's record in previous tournaments, post-1972, Euro 2016 was their first appearance at a European Championships, battled out of the group and reached the last 16. But given how strong this group is, the natural kind of position is to go that Hungary are going to struggle and potentially might not get out of the group. Given the weight of expectation on the other three teams to go on and potentially all have a chance of winning it, can Hungary even get a point from their games in this group? Are they going to end up pointless due to the sheer strength of the other three teams in Group F?
I think the biggest chance is the first game against Portugal. I think Portugal are a team, as we've kind of grown to know with them and see with them, even at the last Euros, which they actually won, they're a team that are a little bit brittle at times and not always that consistent. Hungary probably should have beaten them at the last Euros, and Hungary have got better since then, and Portugal, I don't know, a similar kind of level or maybe got a little bit worse. I mean, Ronaldo's not quite, he's amazing, but he's not quite as at that level he was 5 years ago. And I just feel that Hungary might take Portugal by surprise a little bit. Portugal will be going into that first game not knowing that much about Portugal. Hungary will be fired up massively. Remember, the games are in Budapest, 100%. It'll be sold out stadium. 100% capacity. That game is a home game for Hungary. And I genuinely believe that Hungary will get at least a point there. I actually think they'll win, which sounds crazy. Like, look at the team on paper. It just doesn't look like it's possible. But I think Portugal will underestimate Hungary. And Hungary will be so up for it. They've done their homework on... The players are already... speaking on the 19th of May, the players are already in training. They're already getting ready for that game against Portugal. And I think that's the biggest chance Hungary have got. And I actually do think they'll win. Against Germany and France, it's a little bit different. France are just unbelievable. And they have the players in every position to hurt Hungary. And I think that individual talent that they do have will just be too much. I don't see Hungary getting a point against them. Germany, I think if that game was at home, considering Germany's form recently, I think that they could have a chance. But I think being in Germany, I think that might prove a little bit too much. But I think the biggest opportunity is definitely that first home game against Portugal. If they don't get a point in that, I don't think they'll get a point in the group. But as long as they are competitive in all the games, I think that'll just be the most pleasing thing. I think that's kind of what is expected of them. I don't think they are expected to get a point, to be honest, looking at the teams on paper, but I think they definitely can.
Positivity against Portugal, that's the way forward. Game one is the key for Hungary, according to Thomas. Thomas, thanks so much for your time.
Perfect, no worries.
Great stuff. And up next, we're going to be previewing Portugal with Aaron Barton. We're going to see if he agrees or disagrees with Thomas as Portugal look to defend their European title. Hello and welcome back to the Squawker Talker Euro 2020 Group F preview. Portugal, Cristiano Ronaldo and the gang are back and back to defend their European title. Euro 2016 winners over France, and they're up against Didier Deschamps' side once again in Group F. I'm joined by Aaron Barton from Proximo Jornada, the Portuguese football blog, to preview Portugal, Fernando Santos and some of the decisions that he's going to have to make in terms of his lineup. But given the amount of talent available to Santos, Aaron, you could be forgiven for not having too much sympathy for him. This is a squad full of experience, full of talent. And based on qualification, they weren't fantastic, but we know that Portugal, given the ability of so many players in that team, they're going to be amongst the favourites this summer.
Indeed. You touch on it there, sympathy. It's an embarrassment of riches, but... I'm glad it's him having to decide and not myself, to be honest, because whatever decisions he makes, there's going to be some big names that are omitted, not necessarily from the squad that will be announced tomorrow, but in terms of the starting lineups having to rotate. And we will see some rotation. He likes to keep it fresh. But yeah, it's one of those. Whatever decisions are made, some people are going to be unhappy. Some people are, you know, have things to say about his perhaps more pragmatic approach. But it's won trophies. He delivered Portugal their first ever piece of silverware with the European Championships, and then followed it up with the Nations League. Some fantastic performances in that as well, most notably in the final against Holland. So, yeah, really looking forward to it. It's a tough group, but yeah, we'll see what happens.
And in terms of the squad and obviously some of the decisions that he will have to make in his starting 11 for the group games, there is obviously a huge amount of talent, but with that comes the responsibility of balancing and utilising the players to get his best out of the defending champions. Because going into this tournament, that's what they are. That brings an additional pressure that obviously they didn't feel in 2016. That was off. And particularly in the final, there was so much weight of expectation on France that Portugal were in a position to go out, play the 90 minutes, win the game and get their hands on the trophy. But based on, as I say, qualification, they were squeezed out a top spot by Ukraine, and that kind of consistency hasn't really come back fully. You look at the results so far in 2021 for World Cup qualifying, wins over Azerbaijan, but then 2-2 draw against Serbia has put a little bit of a black mark against them. And Santos has a decision to make. There's arguably a better crop of players individually this time round and a better team, but with that comes a more challenging situation to get it right and get his starting 11 absolutely spot on.
Yeah, totally. And when you talk about 2016, the first word that comes to my mind is cohesion. The team cohesion. A lot of those players knew each other, and obviously his international teammates, you know, they will know each other, but I mean they really knew each other inside out. A lot of them came or had played for Sporting in Portugal, so there was that sort of that DNA in the squad. And then obviously you had the world-class talents that were around. You had the likes of Renato Sanches who were coming through. So there was a real nice mix, and it felt as the tournament, because obviously it wasn't a beautiful tournament as far as Portugal are concerned, going through the group stages, but it felt like as they went into the knockout rounds, they were growing in confidence. And as you say, in the final, they were, you know, rank outsiders, but managed to pull it off. As you say, this time around, arguably more talent in terms of man-for-man individual talents. There's certainly a lot more price tags on the field this time around. A lot of the players are at top European clubs, which is, you know, always the case. But this time around, you've got the emphasis on the likes of Renato Sanches, who's now came back into the fold at Lille, is now actually showing that form he was showing at 2016. So it's came at a really good time for him. The likes of João Félix, who obviously everybody talks about the 125, 130 million euro price tag on his head, hasn't played a lot at Atletico. But when he has played, he's provided some key contributions. He provided another assist just recently, coming off the bench to make it 1-1. And then, yeah, those attacking talents, I think, trying to balance when you're in a group against sides like France and Germany and Hungary as well, to be honest, who can be a dangerous side. It's the balancing act between you can't just put all your attacking players in one go and expect to go gung-ho, because against sides like, you know, the ones in the group, they'll punish you. And we've saw, to be honest, recently in Portugal when they've played those sort of top sides recently, they haven't been thrilling affairs. They haven't been high-scoring affairs. There was the 0-0 with France, 0-0 with Spain. There was the 1-0 loss to France. So they were very, very tight affairs, games where Portugal had to do a lot of defending. And as I say, some people love Fernando Santos and what he's done, and some people are now at the point where they feel they need a manager who will sort of take the reins off a little bit. But as I say, it's easier said than done, because how do you shoehorn in Diogo Jota, João Félix, Cristiano Ronaldo, you know, Bruno Fernandes, Bernardo Silva, all into one team and then be expected as well to keep it really solid and firm at the back? You need the likes of Danilo Pereira, Ruben Neves, William Carvalho, those type of players. So it'll be very interesting to see how he goes with the team. You can expect them to go with a 4-3-3, and it will be... William Carvalho was dropped for the last round of games. He's not been playing a lot at Betis. But with the extra allocation in the squad, and Fernando Santos likes him, knows what he brings to the table, and he likes to go with players who he knows what they offer.
Looking at some of the decisions that are possibly already made, we'll touch on the midfield and how he's going to get this balance right and the potential for some pretty big names that might not be starting that first game against Hungary in the tournament. At the back, Ruben Dias has been fantastic for Manchester City this season. key part of their team in winning the Premier League and reaching the Champions League final. There's every likelihood that he's going to have an old war horse next to him, either Pepe or Jose Fonts, depending on which decision Santos goes for. And Portugal have this huge amount of attacking talent and lots of depth in midfield, but starting from the back, Diaz and Pepe or Diaz and Fonts are absolutely key. And when we look at some of the games, and the most interesting one is the rematch of the final against France, the third group game, which could potentially decide either Portugal or France's fate going into the knockout stages. Diaz against Mbappe, the rematch of the first leg between City and PSG in the Champions League, is going to be really interesting because Diaz has got a lot of praise for the way that he dealt with Haaland against Dortmund, the way that he dealt with Mbappe against PSG in the first leg. And Diaz only really knows one way to do it. He goes up high, he plays a high line. If the ball goes in behind, he backs himself to catch them. And given the fact that Diaz will be leading front foot forward and looking to get Portugal really high up the pitch, do you think he's able to pull that off with Portugal as effectively as he does with Manchester City?
Probably not to the extreme lengths of the success that he's pulled off at Manchester City. But to be honest, in terms of his positioning, he'll probably just start a little bit deeper on the pitch. Then also you've got to factor in the fact that he's playing alongside someone like Pep, who doesn't, obviously he's not relying on pace as he goes into his late 30s. But he's someone who's got a wealth of experience, you know, whether the balls are coming into the box, whether it's his positioning on the pitch and where to be, interceptions, tackles, he can do it all. And then having Diaz alongside him, I think it's just a case of always remaining switched on, because as you say, there's a lot of pace in both the Germany side and the France side. There's a lot of pace in there. Front foot forward, they like to play, you know, high and wide. And thinking, especially Germany, they like to Leroy Sané and Timo Werner, people that rely on getting in behind. So it'll be interesting to see whether he does change slightly in terms of maybe playing a little bit deeper. And with Manchester City, he's playing for a team that aim to have, you know, 60, 70%, sometimes more, possession of the ball. Portugal aren't like that. So, you know, in a couple of the recent Portugal games, they've had 40, 45% possession of the ball, still managed to come out as winners. But I feel like it's two different systems. Pep Guardiola and Fernando Santos are two completely different managers. So, yeah, you have to factor in that as well. When he's a Manchester City player, that's great. That's the way he plays. When he comes and plays for Portugal, he's equally as good. I always think back to that Nations League final against Holland. He was world class. He was on another level that day. He was absolutely fantastic. And he was still getting a little bit of criticism in Portugal as well from Portuguese football supporters and journalists alike. There was still some improvements that he needed to make. And I don't think when he came to England, we knew that he was a top central defender, but a lot of people didn't see him doing this well. So he's been an absolute revelation, and hope he can just take that into the European Championships, because he is world class.
Looking at midfield, you said that Santos is not afraid to make pragmatic choices if he thinks it's best for an individual game or to get the best out of his front three or potentially even a front four. And systems, he switched between two kind of number sixes or a straight three across the middle. And given the fact that, as you touched on, there's so many names that he can potentially pick from to start, Bernardo Silva can drop in there, but from a defensive point of view, you've got Danilo, Renato Sanchez, Ruben Neves playing for Wolves, Jean Moutinho also playing for Wolves, who's massively, massively experienced. And Bruno Fernandes, we haven't even talked about, and obviously he's had another fantastic season with Manchester United. But given the fact that there is this need for balance to make sure that Portugal are not caught short, particularly against the better teams as we approach the knockout stages, there is the big, strong potential that some names, some high-profile names could miss out. And you mentioned, as we were discussing before we started recording, that Bruno Fernandes, despite the fact that he's absolutely massive for Man United, is not a certain starter for Portugal.
No, I think if you look at his Portugal career so far, he hasn't always been a guaranteed starter. The more games he plays, and as we come into the present day, he's started more and more games. But you think back to the Spain game, he didn't start in that game. The one, I think it was in 2019 or 2020, And in the recent game against Luxembourg, he didn't start. Obviously, it was, you know, more of a resting where he wanted to sort of just put a bit of freshness into some of the other players. But yeah, there's the whole argument that Bruno doesn't perform as well for Portugal as he does for Manchester United, or indeed as he did for when he was at Sporting. So, which is a fair argument, because the way that they play is completely different. It's international football where you do need to be a little bit more pragmatic in terms of turnovers in possession. You're playing against someone like France or Germany, can't really afford to give the ball away as much as Bruno might do for Manchester United. And as we spoke off air, I said that absolutely love him as a player, love him for Manchester United. And I'd actually prefer my midfielder to try and play those incisive passes and those eye-of-the-needle passes and give the ball away, because that's what's going to happen. I'd rather that than have a midfielder who has 98% passing accuracy, but all he did was go, you know, to the left-back or go back to the central defender or whatever it may be. But Fernando Santos is a manager that has to win trophies, or he's aiming to win trophies. He's got to win football matches and tournament football. Things can change very quickly. So I think you will see a little bit of rotation, the likes of Bruno Fernandes, and what he might do with Bernardo Silva in terms of, I see Silva more as a central midfielder when he plays as that in a 4-3-3, as that third man in midfield. Is remarkable. His positioning is remarkable. His work ethic, what he does for the cause, both offensively and defensively. Whether he plays as a right winger, which again takes away a slot from a more natural winger, and when I say that, I mean someone that wants to go high and wide and go to the byline and beat a man. Bernardo is more like playing an attacking midfielder, sort of out wide. So be interesting to see what happens there. And then if William Carvalho wasn't called up to the most recent qualifiers, because he hasn't been getting a lot of game time for Real Betis in La Liga, but he's someone that Fernando Santos trusts. He knows what he brings to the table. Obviously the squad has been extended now, so there's extra places in there. So, and then you've got the likes of Danilo Pereira, who's played a little bit more recently for Paris Saint-Germain, Ruben Neves, João Moutinho. There's lots of talent in there, but it's trying to get it all. And it's trying to make sure that it doesn't compromise the what's going on in the front three, because that's where the party is, really. Is that's where the action is. So you've got to make sure that if you've got a real hot attacking trio, that you balance it out with the midfield, because you can't go gung-ho against France and Germany. It can't be done.
You've obviously mentioned the party up top. Cristiano Ronaldo will be leading the party, despite the fact that Juventus have not had the best of season. They've obviously failed to defend their Serie A title. That won't affect him. He's one of these players that when he turns up for his national team, he's absolutely plugged into what he needs to do in order to get them success. We all remember the scenes in 2016 in the final when he went off injured and he was almost a de facto coach alongside Santos, getting Portugal over the line to win it. But given the fact that there is so much talent, as we've touched on, in terms of supporting casts to a star player, they don't really come much better than Portugal. We look at France and the way their team is structured around certain players and potentially even England and Spain. But given the fact that Ronaldo will be the tip of the sword right the way through the middle, Bernardo Silva, Yao Felix, Bruno Fernandes, if he does start or if he comes off the bench, there's so much talent around him, but still a fair portion is still geared towards getting the ball to Ronaldo, because he makes that key difference.
And again, there's another argument. That's another really big discussion in Portugal at the moment, is are Portugal, dare they say it, better without Ronaldo, or are they better with him on the pitch? Now, this argument has came out in, not a recent argument, probably maybe 18 months to 2 years. I think it was more after the Portugal played against Croatia in the Nations League, and this is Croatia fresh off them doing really well at the World Cup and, you know, a top side. And Portugal without Ronaldo absolutely dismantled them. They didn't play with a focus and emphasis on a focal point up front. It was more interchangeable. You saw players appearing in sort of in the false nine and then moving. It was very fluid. The football was electric, and they ran out 4-1 winners. They absolutely battered them. And that, I think, got a lot of people thinking, you know, I wonder what Portugal would be like sort of going into the future. But to be honest, I wouldn't rush to try and displace him, because at the end of the day, he scores goals. He is showing no signs of slowing down in terms of the goals that he's getting. The way he's changed as a player, and say he's more of a traditional number nine now. So yeah, you are going to gear it towards him because he's one of the best headers of the football that's ever played, and his he brings other people into play. And, you know, those wingers either side of him will be absolutely made up to be playing with him. And make no mistake about it, he'll be starting every single game. He's not one of those names where you can say, oh, maybe he'll rest this game. Ronaldo, if he's fit, he will play because he will want to play. And Fernando Santos knows just what he brings. So it's how does he then bring into that supporting cast, whether it be João Félix or whether it be Bernardo Silva, if he starts out wide. Diogo Jota, we haven't spoke about, is he's becoming a real cult hero amongst Portuguese football supporters, because every time he pulls on the Seleção jersey, he's amazing. He's fantastic. He scored two brilliant headers. There's actually three headers, I think, over two games. But he was recently scored two in one match, and he was he was absolutely tremendous, and someone that's starting to get Portuguese football supporters really excited. And with the news of his injury the last couple of days, and then obviously Klopp came out yesterday and said it doesn't look as bad as first feared, there's actually a chance he could make the match day squad for one of Liverpool's games towards the end of the season. So huge sigh of relief, because obviously they've already lost Pedro Neto, and just have to give him a mention, because what a tremendous season, what a tremendous young talent. I think It gave me Bernardo Silva vibes with 2016. The same thing happened there. He was starting to burst out onto the scene. Silva was actually being touted as going to the European Championships, got injured. Same thing with Pedro Neto. He wasn't 100% guaranteed to be on the plane, but you know, he gives Portugal something a little bit different. He's you know, he's electric, he's skillful, he's pacey, he likes to put the ball in the box, he likes to take his man on, likes to come inside. So he will be a huge blow, but I'm sure Portugal have got the personnel there to more than make up for it.
And looking at the group, Portugal's record is fantastic. They've got out of the group every European Championship since 1996. Obviously defending the title going into this one, this summer, Euro 2020. It does bring its own weight of pressure, as you mentioned before, because they're approaching this as defending champions, which they've never done before. But despite the fact that this looks like a demanding group, obviously France are in there who are pushing to go for the world and European double. Germany, despite the fact that there's a bit of an argument, they're not the force that they were a few years ago. They are absolutely incredible at major tournaments in the majority. Where do you see Portugal landing? If things go well and the knockout stages play in their favour, they could go all the way to the final. Do you think that's a realistic possibility?
Yeah, 100%. And I don't like really making predictions, especially when it comes to Portugal, because it always comes back to bite me as a fan and as a supporter, first and foremost, over, you know, journalism. But I think if Portugal get out of the group stages, then there's nothing to say that they don't go on all the way to the final and possibly win it, because that group stage itself is, you know, that looks like semi-finals of a tournament. You've got Portugal playing Hungary on the opening day, and then obviously you've got France and Germany, and then Portugal, Germany, Portugal, France. So it will be a huge test. And Portugal never seemed to start very, very, what's the word? They don't start on the front foot sometimes. They can be a little bit lethargic to get going. We saw that in 2016, and that can be the issue. Same with 2018 in the World Cup. The group stage is a little bit. But yeah, I see if Portugal can get out of the group stage, which I think they will. I think it's important to start off with 3 points against Hungary. Whilst Germany and France are playing each other, get 3 points on the board and hope for maybe a draw in the other game or for a win for one of the other sides and aim to go through as a second place team. But I think if they can get points against Hungary and then against Germany will be the big one to take points from, because France is one of those games you think you'd be forgiven to say you go in there, and if you get a point, brilliant. You know, if you manage to pull off a win, excellent. But I think Germany are the ones to look at, really, because I don't think they're as good as they once were, and I think that's fair to say it, to be honest. But we'll see when we get to the tournament, because Germany are one of those sides that can turn it on when they need to, despite the form that they come into the tournament in. And yeah, I mean, I hope Portugal go all the way. I hope they win it. I hope they defend the crown. But the nerves have started to kick in already, to be honest.
Great stuff, Aaron. Thanks so much for your input on Portugal. Hopefully they can defend their title. I'm sure you'll be raising a glass to them this summer if they manage it.
Indeed. Thanks for having me, guys.
Great stuff. Up next is France. Didier Deschamps is not happy with Antoine Griezmann, Kylian Mbappe, N'Golo Kante and Paul Pogba. He wants to bring back a former powerhouse. Karim Benzema is back. We're going to be talking all about him and Les Bleus' chances this summer in just a second. Hello and welcome back to the Squawker Talker Euro 2020 Group F preview. France, the world champions, are back in business, and Didier Deschamps is looking to clinch a world and European double. A Le Bleu squad that is absolutely dripping with experience and talent, but Mr. Deschamps was not completely happy because he's added one very controversial name to his list. Karim Benzema is included in the France squad for the first time since 2015. That is the big story. We're joined by French journalist Matt Spiro to look at Benzema's return and analyse France's chances ahead of the tournament. The big story is Benzema, Matt, coming back into the team. And prior to maybe 48 hours before the squad was announced, it was still up in the air whether he would come back, whether there would be conversations. This is a massively controversial story in France. What has been the reaction in terms of Benzema's recall from the fans? Deschamps has been very strong over the last 5 to 6 years that Benzema wouldn't come back. This looks like a pretty big U-turn from the France manager.
Absolutely. Look, it's been a massive story for 5 or 6 years in France. And despite the fact that Deschamps has been so firm, every time Karim Benzema scores a brilliant goal, scores a hat-trick with Real Madrid, wins the Champions League with Real Madrid, you know, the whole debate resurfaces, and Didier Deschamps has got very tired answering the questions before every get-together. Are you going to consider Karim Benzema? And it all grew a bit tiresome for Didier Deschamps. This decision, this U-turn, has come totally out of the blue. It was on the morning of the announcement, the squad announcement, that one or two rumours were doing the rounds in the press, and that gathered pace through the day that Didier Deschamps was going to be recalling Karim Benzema. Nobody saw it coming. Didier Deschamps has explained that a while back, he hasn't given specific details, but a while back he met up with Karim Benzema and had a very long discussion and a very serious discussion. He didn't make a decision at that moment, Deschamps. He digested it, he said, over several weeks. And his decision was to bring Karim Benzema back. So the reaction in France has been overwhelmingly positive. Everybody is so happy because it has been this cloud over the French national team. And it's been a wonderful period for France. Finals in 2016 at the Euros, obviously World Cup winners in 2018. But like I say, every time Benzema shines, and he's been doing it an awful lot in the last couple of years, people say, well, you know, what a sad state of affairs that this guy is not doing it for the French national team. So everybody is happy. Olivier Giroud perhaps inwardly isn't happy because he may well be losing his place. But, you know, for football lovers, for supporters in France, it's fantastic news.
And obviously having him back in brings in experience, it brings in goals to an already superstar French attack. But as you say, when you look back at their record in previous tournaments in the last few years, defeating the final in Euro 2016 and then winning the World Cup in 2018, this is an incredible squad that's already available to Deschamps. Bringing Benzema back into that, given the profile that he has within the domestic game, within La Liga, within his position in the Real Madrid squad, is there a danger of it being an unsettling presence? Because as you say, it's been this cloud that's hung over French media, France football fans, and Deschamps is constantly asked about it. Given the fact that he's now going to come in, will he be accepted back in? Will he just seamlessly slot into the squad ahead of the tournament? Because it's a very tight turnaround between now and when the tournament kicks off. A couple of friendly games and a training camp to get embedded in and to get everybody pulling in the right direction, because France are under big pressure to go out and win this competition. And he's been brought in on a pragmatic ticket of, he offers these amount of goals. There's no time for other issues to be balanced. We just want the Benzema that puts the ball in the back of the net.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things that need to be highlighted. Yes, France have been very strong in recent years. Their success, particularly in Russia, was very much founded on a fantastic defence protected by N'Golo Kanté and Blaise Matuidi and Paul Pogba, and the pace of Kylian Mbappe. Now, without wanting to downplay Olivier Giroud, because his contribution has been absolutely fantastic and he's scored a lot of goals and he has a fantastic relationship with Antoine Griezmann as well. I think that duo has been very important to France's success. He's not in the same category as Karim Benzema, who is, you know, for my money and for most people in France, among the top two or three best strikers in world football right now. And, you know, why would you deny yourself the possibility of having a talent like that if it was doable? Now, back in the day, 5-6 years ago, there was the issue with Mathieu Valbuena also being in contention for a place in the France squad, and it was very, very difficult for Didier Deschamps to deal with his playmaker and his striker, who were having this enormous court case and ongoing legal proceedings over the sex tape scandal. Mathieu Valbuena is no longer in contention anymore. So in that respect, there isn't so much of a problem. The other big issue with Didier Deschamps was the fallout, notably from an interview that Karim Benzema did with Marca in Spain before Euro 2016, when he suggested that Deschamps had been influenced by a racist part of France. And Didier Deschamps suffered a lot in terms of his family and his own reputation, and he found that very, very difficult to deal with. Now it seems that after having long discussions with Benzema, he is prepared to put that to one side and to welcome one of the best strikers in world football back into his squad. So, you know, I think that is overwhelmingly positive. I think it's important to also stress that Karim Benzema has never been an unsettling presence in any of his club sides or in the French national team, where he was popular up until the moment where the sex tape affair made it untenable for him to come back into the France fold. However, you're quite right to say this is a squad of World Cup winners. There are egos, there's a hierarchy, and the squad is welcoming back somebody who is at the very summit of his game, somebody who is returning as a leader, who will be the centre forward, and who, of course, has an ego as well. Now, the World Cup winners in 2018 were very much the generation of Varane, Pogba and Griezmann. So I think already we have this issue that Kylian Mbappe, who exploded in 2018, has become the star of the team. How is everybody else going to deal with that? We've now got this other enormous presence in Karim Benzema. So it is going to be a heady mix of egos, I think it's fair to say, of talent. And Didier Deschamps has got a big job on his hands.
Well, it's a balancing act, particularly, as you say, egos as well as talent. You have to decide what is best for the team. And obviously in 2016 and 2018, Deschamps did a fantastic job of looking to kind of bring forward the incredible talent of Mbappe, but also balance it against that resilient defence you mentioned with Rafa Varane at centre-half alongside Samuel Umtiti. Paul Pogba was magnificent in midfield alongside Conte. But we'll come back to Benzema in a second and where he fits into the attacking unit. A few decisions do seem to already be made for Deschamps, maybe to lighten the load on himself a little bit in terms of that starting 11. Hugo Lloris, you would imagine, will keep his place in goal. Massively experienced, obviously played a key role in winning the World Cup. Benjamin Pavard and Lucas Hernandez at fullback. Rafa Varane, there's obviously a little bit of speculation over his future at Real Madrid, but another solid season and he's key for France. Samuel Umtiti was his regular partner in 2018, but his Barcelona career has, quite frankly, gone off a cliff due to injuries and a lack of form. Who is the big candidate to slot in there alongside Varane, particularly when, as you mentioned, you've got a squad full of World Cup winners? That back four has just won a World Cup in 2018. Umtiti is not going to be alongside Varane this time round. Whoever comes in will need to have a big presence as well as a lot of talent.
Yeah, listen, I think Presnel Kimpembe is very much the first choice partner for Varane in Didier Deschamps' mind. He has really let Deschamps down. I think he's really grown as a footballer as well, played a very minor role at the World Cup in 2018. But, you know, he's a senior player at Paris Saint-Germain. Essentially, the decision that was made a year ago by PSG to sell or to allow Thiago Silva to leave, albeit a decision Thomas Tuchel didn't agree with at the time. But it was based on the fact that Presnel Kimpembe had made that step forward and was considered a top-class centre-back. And to be fair, he has shown that pretty much throughout what has been a very long and difficult season for PSG. Kimpembe alongside Marquinhos, they have been largely very, very strong. Now, I know one or two people might point to one or two mistakes from Kimpembe in the Champions League in particular. But, you know, I think he's a very strong personality and I think he's very much ready to assume the role of being a first-choice centre-back for France. That coupled with Clément Longley struggling in recent months with Barcelona, I think there's not too much doubt in Deschamps' mind.
And in terms of midfield, obviously, Pogba and Kante, you would expect them to be immediate first choices in the centre of the park, but there's possibly an option for someone in there alongside them. Again, you go back to 2018 and the World Cup final, there's been changes to Deschamps' structure of the midfield and in terms of the way that they approach games. If Pogba and Kante are nailed on to start, whether Pogba maybe plays slightly deeper than he does with Manchester United, or they allow that holding role to just be occupied by Conte. We've seen him do it brilliantly this season, particularly in the Champions League against Real Madrid, where he was man of the match in both legs. Who is best placed to join them in midfield ahead of the tournament this summer?
I think it depends a little bit on the system, as you say, that Didier Deschamps is going to play. Conte and Pogba are most definitely nailed on, first choices. They'll play in front of the defence, and I think Pogba will have a little bit more of a licence to go forward. But Deschamps likes to use him in this deep-lying role where they can use his energy and also his long passing game. And then it's a question of whether it's a midfield three, in which case we're looking at Adrien Rabiot, I think, as the definite preference at the moment for Didier Deschamps. Something of a surprise because Deschamps, we know that he holds grudges, but maybe he's mellowing a bit in his older age, let's say, because Rabiot was on the reserve list for the 2018 World Cup, and he really angered Deschamps by basically refusing to be on standby for the World Cup. But Deschamps was impressed with the way he's taken to life at Juventus, and Rabiot's done well, actually, when he's come in for France this season. And he seems to be the one who is taking the place of Blaise Matuidi in France's World Cup plans. That said, if France do play a 4-2-3-1 with a more defensive or more of a sort of midfielder in the Matuidi mould on the left-hand side, which is what they did in the World Cup, then Tomalemba, I think, comes into contention. I think we're really seeing the Tomalemba of old that we loved when he won the league at Monaco. I think he's taken time to adapt at Atletico Madrid to Diego Simeone's methods, but he's had a really good season, and I think he could be a good fit on the left side. If they want somebody who can sort of track back, they've got some big games in that group stage. Obviously, I don't want to leave Hungary out, but Portugal and Germany in particular have got so much attacking talent. So, you know, I think the choice is between Tomalemba and Adrien Rabiot for me for that extra midfield role.
Looking at the attack, and obviously, inevitably, we come back to Karim Benzema. And just when you look at his numbers, it goes back to the point that you made right at the beginning of he has been so incredible for the last few seasons with Real Madrid. Kylian Mbappe is the only player to have outscored him at domestic level that's in the France squad. He scored more goals than Ben Yedder, Giroud and Griezmann. And particularly Griezmann, who's got such an important role in this France team in the World Cup, he was massively important. And that trio of Giroud, Griezmann and Mbappe worked brilliantly. Giroud was obviously very selfless in his role, and obviously there were question marks about the level of quality that he was able to bring in some of the big, big knockout games, but that was negated by the fact that he created so much for the pace of Mbappe going in one direction, the creativity of Griezmann on the other. But this idea of egos and balancing it, Mbappe, Griezmann and Benzema on paper look to be the front three. Those are three big egos who, if you take Lionel Messi out of Barcelona, Antoine Griezmann is the big star in their attack. Kylian Mbappe, arguably, with the PSG fans, is a bigger star than Neymar in that team. And Karim Benzema is definitely, in the post-Ronaldo era, the big star at Real Madrid. So it's a balancing act. And as I say, on paper, they look like the three. Will they be the three, or is that just a case of throwing the best three players together doesn't always work that way. Could somebody else break in and start?
Olivier Giroud is never stronger or never better than when people rule him out. So I think what we shouldn't forget is that since he took charge in 2012, Olivier Giroud is the player he's picked more than any other player. Giroud was the top scorer in qualifying for the Euros once again. He's closing in on the all-time France scoring record. He's 7 shy of Thierry Henry. He wants to break Henry's record. So it would be a brave man to rule Olivier Giroud out. Now, I'm going to be brave. I'm going to say that barring any injury to Benzema, Griezmann and Mbappe, that they are going to be the front three. And I think what we've seen in the early Deschamps years is that it doesn't work Benzema and Giroud up top together. He's tried it with France, mainly playing Benzema out wide. They don't get on particularly as footballers. I don't think there's a problem with their relationship off the pitch, but they don't quite click as footballers. And I think Mbappe and Benzema will click as footballers. It was interesting just after the announcement by Didier Deschamps, Kylian Mbappe very quickly managed to put together a photo montage of himself giving Karim Benzema a high five in the France shirt. And I think Mbappe will be hugely excited.
It was almost as if
his people had maybe got it ready. But he is very excited. People in Real Madrid are very excited because they think that that could be the future partnership for Real Madrid, Mbappe and Benzema. And I think in many ways, Karim Benzema coming back is going to help Kylian Mbappe because he's not necessarily going to be the focal point anymore. Everybody's going to be so keen to see how Benzema gets on. Is he going to fit in? Is he going to be, integrated and playing for the team? That people might talk a bit less about Mbappe. And, given the season that he's had, 40 goals so far in all competitions, given his incredible hunger just to rewrite football history, that could play into Mbappe's hands. And I also think, talking about the egos, yes, they of course they do. They're multi-millionaires. They're told constantly that they're the best things since sliced bread. But Karim Benzema is a very collective player. He's a team player. He won't be getting the ball and dribbling and trying to go for goal himself. Benzema's, the reason he's such a world-class footballer is because he has a fantastic football brain. And he will drop deep and he will help to knit things together. And I do think that will help Mbappe as well, because he'll have Benzema dropping off. He'll have balls in behind from Benzema and from Antoine Griezmann. And I do think Benzema coming into the team, even though it did work well with Giroud, I think it will play even more into Kylian Mbappe's hands.
And it's a measure of just the sheer amount of talent that's available today, Sean. We talked about who will start, who could potentially rotate in if there's an injury or he wants to change things up. And we still haven't mentioned Wissam Ben Yedder, Ousmane Dembele and Marcus Thuram, who's from Borussia Mönchengladbach. And we've seen little snippets of Thuram. Obviously, his famous father is something that's kind of maybe pushed him into the limelight in terms of a media star. But the goals and the performances that he's turned in for Borussia Mönchengladbach have been really impressive. Really composed on the ball. He can beat players out wide, create chances, score a goal. And France are clearly not short of attacking options. We know that, and we know that based on the squad that Deschamps has named. But there's always room for maybe someone that the wider picture are not as aware of. And Thuram falls into that. Ben Yedder is well known. He's obviously excelled when he played in the Liga. Now he's back playing in Ligue 1. Dembele is playing for Barcelona. He's right up there in terms of world-class players when he's playing with Lionel Messi and Griezmann at club level. But Thuram is someone that, on his day, is absolutely devastating. And Deschamps, as together as he is and regular in terms of the lineup that he picks, there's always room for somebody that you might not see coming, and that could be Thuram.
It could be Thuram. I think it wasn't necessarily expected that he'd be included. He's had some disciplinary problems in the last few months, but he made a very good impression when he was selected earlier this season by Didier Deschamps. He's got a good attitude by all accounts. Didier Deschamps knows his father extremely well. And like you say, very good, strong, skillful player who can play out wide, who can play through the middle. I just wonder, I, I, I feel he's being brought along, not just for the experience, but I think certainly Dembele and Kingsley Coman are much more in Deschamps' mind when it comes to picking that wide player. You know, if he goes for the 4-2-3-1 in a more attacking sense, not with a Rabiot or a Tomalemar, then I think Coman, Kingsley Coman is the first choice. He's a devastating player on his day and has shown some outstanding form as well for Bayern Munich. And, you know, Ousmane Dembele, his time is going to have to come. We thought it was going to come in 2018. He started the first game for France in that World Cup, and it was all very disappointing, not just from him, but from the French attack in that opening game against Australia. And it was when he was taken off for Matuidi and Giroud came on again, and everything changed in terms of Deschamps' plans. But Dembele has shown some good form as well in the second half of the season for Barcelona, and he's an immensely talented player. So, you know, Deschamps has a lot of options, and it could be a question of who takes his chance, you know, in terms of the preparation matches and gets the nod for the first game and can perhaps keep his place from there on in.
Looking at France's previous record in tournaments, France fans don't need to be reminded that when they win something or finish as runner-up, they tend to flop in the following tournament. You know, bad memories if we go back to the World Cup in 2002. But this time around, it doesn't seem to be that case, and they don't come much bigger than Germany away in the first game in Group F this time round. There will obviously be that nagging pressure of favourites, this incredible squad, huge experience, World Cup winners right the way through the panel that have been picked this time round. That won't affect them mentally because there is so much experience. But do you see the path being laid out for France to go all the way? Do you think France can go on and win this?
I think France are capable of imploding. I think France are always capable of imploding. And if it goes badly wrong in the first game against Germany, you never know. But what I would say is that since Deschamps took charge in 2012, this trend of boom and then crash has stopped. And Deschamps has got control of the national team. And France have stability for the past decade, whether that is at the very highest level, the president of the FA, Noël Legret, who arrived in 2011, Deschamps in 2012. That's what they were lacking. They were lacking good, strong leadership at the very highest level. They've got that now. And, you know, it's actually been quite a smooth progression if you consider they were World Cup quarter finalists in 2014, Euro finalists in 2016, World Cup winners in 2018. So, yes, of course, they could have a tremendous crash back down to earth. But I think they're very stable now. And we talked about the spine in this team, the strong personalities. I think there is every chance they will be in the latter stages of the competition. And I can certainly see them reaching the final and possibly Didier Deschamps making history and becoming the first manager ever to win the World Cup and the Euros, having already done it as a player.
Yeah, huge summer ahead for Deschamps and for France. But as you say, the chance for history, let's hope it doesn't weigh too heavy on his shoulders. Matt, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Great stuff. And to complete Group F, we're going to be previewing Germany. That's coming up in just a second. Hello and welcome back to the Squawker Talker Euro 2020 Group F preview podcast. And wrapping up Group F, we have Germany, powerhouses of European football, heading into Euro 2020 in what is going to be Joachim Löw's last tournament as Germany boss. Huge amount of talking points swirling around Germany, the national team, and Löw and his future ahead of the tournament. To look ahead to all of that, I'm joined by Bundesliga expert Jasmin Baba. Jasmin, before we get into Löw and obviously the impact that his decision to leave the team after the tournament, the two big squad selections that he's made have been the returns of Thomas Müller and Mats Hummels, who've been essentially in international exile for the last two seasons. Joachim Löw has opted to not call them up for some time. There's been obviously a little bit of public pressure to bring them back in, having had very strong seasons with Bayern and Borussia Dortmund. So they're back in the squad, adding obviously a huge amount of experience to the squad ahead of the tournament. What have been the main reasons behind Löw bringing them back in, and what's been the public reaction to them being recalled?
Well, I think as this is his last hurrah, basically, he cares a lot less about the development of the youngest team He wanted to move away from the old guard, from the qualifiers after the really, really bad showing in the World Cup, the last World Cup in 2018. So he wanted to go a new approach. Now that he's decided to leave, he's basically thrown that out the window and just wants to secure the final bit of his legacy. And you can't really turn away at Thomas Müller, especially this season, at something like 11 goals and 18 assists in that Bayern Munich team. So for that, it was really a no-brainer, as he really wants to go all out and win the European Championship this time round. Matt Hummels, again, maybe not as big on form as much as Müller has been this season, but especially his kind of experienced role, his slight leadership within the team, his Dortmund winning a piece of silverware, it's really big for them. So for him to bring that them both in, yeah, there's been a little bit of pressure, I think, but there was pressure for them to go a younger approach before as well. So I think they're all kind of coming to agreeing with this kind of decision made by Jogi Löw.
And in terms of where they'll fit in the squad, having been out of it for 2 years, the team have essentially moved on. Löw has found a different way of playing that is not as reliant on them as two big star players. The fact that they've come back into the squad, it's a similar comparison, obviously, with Karim Benzema returning for the French national side. Hummels and Müller, you would not expect them to be sitting on the bench for Euro 2020. Antonio Rudiger and Matthias Ginter have formed a fairly solid partnership at the back for Germany, particularly at the start of 2021. And we'll touch on Müller a little bit later in terms of the attack. But does Mats Hummels just come straight back into the starting team? And if he does, who misses out?
I honestly depends on the formation Löw goes. Now, this is basically thrown up so many possibilities throughout the team. I think against France, their first opening game in the Euros, I think we could see Hummels start, especially if he plays a back 3-5. I think Hummels will be the centre back of that of those three, followed by Ginter to one side and Rudiger by the other. You've got experience, you've got quite a bit of a defensive-based formation against that very, very strong French team. However, if he goes with a back four, I can see Hummels then being on the bench. I think there are better partnerships, as you said, the Ginter and Rudiger partnership. You've also got... also, it's worked a little bit better with Klosterman, Halstenberg, Gosens as the fullbacks in that squad. So, yeah, again, it depends on the formation he goes with.
And looking at the midfield, in terms of selection, there's maybe one or two headaches that he'll have to deal with. But before we look at Toni Kroos coming back in, he missed the World Cup qualifiers through injury. Joshua Kimmich has emerged as the fulcrum of this Germany team. And we've seen, obviously, with the example of his former Bayern Munich teammate, Philipp Lahm, moving from fullback into a central area at the base of the midfield. Kimmich is key to this Germany team in terms of linking defence with midfield and ensuring that the whole side is ticking over. He's gone from being someone that was a fullback impressed in that position to now moving into arguably Germany's most important player.
Definitely, and especially how you have that Bayern Munich block of players. It would be silly to kind of mess around with that, especially if you've got Kimmich and Goretzka, if you're playing them both in a double pivot. If you play a 4-1-4-1 or a 4-3-3, Kimmich as the single pivot player, and then you do open up that kind of other possibilities of having Kroos and Gundogan on either side of him, or Müller as a 10 in front. In the kind of back three with the four in the midfield, you can play him, Kroos and Kimmich together. So you've got so many possibilities there, and they should all work. I know there was the 6-0 battering against Spain recently, which kind of questioned a lot of things and if that midfield could do it. But if you look at the defence that they played with Süle, Koch, I can't remember the fullbacks in that team, but you know, it was a very weak and inexperienced defence. So I still think those kind of interchangeable roles across the midfield can still definitely work.
Germany have to do it the hard way in terms of the way that the group is structured. France in game one and Portugal in game two, and then wrapping up against Hungary when they're looking to hopefully be pushing to get into the knockout stages. Given how strong France are in that area, Portugal have got a massive amount of midfield talent. It's essential that Le gets that midfield balance right. Do you think it's more likely, as you say, that he might go a little bit more cautious, play a slightly more defensive setup with maybe Kimmich and Goretzka, or include someone that can get a goal? We've seen with Ilkay Gundogan at Manchester City this season, he's added over double figures in terms of goals to his game. Against France, there is the temptation to be cautious, to not leave yourself wide open, but Germany and the pressure that Le will be under will not be to cede ground to France. They'll want to be proactive and impact Germany's game on France.
I think with France, even if you take a more defensive structure and setup with the back three, they've still got such good wing backs in Klostermann and Gerstens, which they would have been experienced under Klostermann, especially under Nagelsmann in that role. Your offensive midfielders, you still play Gnabry and Sané. Up top, you can have Havertz, Forland, who's been great for Monaco. You know, you have, even in defensive structures, you can still balance that when someone like a Gnabry gets the ball, you would expect him to do well against that French team, especially how I'm not quite sure how France will line up their defence, especially with the omission of Upamecano. And then against someone like Portugal, okay, maybe they won't win against France. We've seen what France can do and the offensive players they have. But against Portugal, if they go with the buy-in block of players in the 4-2-3-1 that all German teams are used to, France plays in, you probably could get a more offensive kind of working way through that Portugal midfield. It's definitely not impossible just because most of these players have played for the best team in the world for the last year, winning absolutely everything. So I don't think the kind of hope for the best tactic will be necessary here because they've definitely got the talent to at least get a win against Portugal, a win against Hungary, and a draw against France will see them through. Even a loss, you probably will get through as the third best team.
Kai Havertz is an interesting option for Le and in terms of where he deploys him in this team. Premier League fans, Chelsea fans will know that we've kind of seen two versions of Havertz this season. The Frank Lampard version where he didn't really utilise him to the best of his ability. Obviously, Havertz has been quite open about the fact that it's taken him some time to adjust to living in England and obviously testing positive for COVID, that set him back by another period. But since Thomas Tuchel has come in, we've seen the best of Kai Havertz in the Premier League. And one of the biggest strengths that we've seen from him is this ability to play in different roles. He doesn't necessarily naturally look like a number nine and an outright striker, but within Tuchel's Chelsea, he has operated in that position. And given the fact that there is need for flexibility, particularly in an attacking lineup that includes Sané and Gnabry, as you mentioned, that versatility that Havertz offers could be absolutely crucial because he's very, very difficult to mark in terms of the positions that he takes up.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, I'm hoping he is the more favourable number nine of this team. I personally wouldn't want to rely on Timo Werner as a number nine or an out-and-out striker at the moment. Even though he had such a clinical record at RB Leipzig before joining Chelsea, he did have those moments where he looked completely out of confidence in front of goal. And he is known to squander a really big chance. And you can't risk that in these kind of knockout games in a group stage, which is filled with quality and talent that you need to take every chance. I think Havertz probably is more favourable. I would hope he is. If neither of them look good, then you've always can rely on Müller. There's been talk of Gnabry playing in that role, but I honestly think Havertz will be used as a number nine.
And looking at, obviously, Muller back in the squad, we talked there about Werner and his very frustrating ability to miss chances, not just for the German national side. We've seen it a number of times for Chelsea, but I think most people can see it is just an issue of adapting. It's just taking him a little bit longer to get used to the Premier League and the types of movements and the types of chances that are created for him. And as you say, tournaments, particularly in the group stage, when you've got such strong opposition, there's no room for sentiment. There's no room for second chances. You need somebody that can be reliable in front of goal. And ironically, that is now Thomas Muller. He has 38 international goals, which is more than Werner and Gnabry put together. So there will be a temptation to play Muller. But as you said, Havertz, you would tip for the number nine role, maybe not in a traditional sense, but there has to be a place for Muller. Will it be a starting place or will it be from the bench?
Again, it's down to formation. I can see him starting in a 4-2-3-1, especially, again, if Kimmich is behind him, if Goretzka is behind him, you'd play that kind of Bayern midfield trio. He can excel in a number 10 role. He can also excel on a right wing role as well. He has done before. But he could be changed up with Gnabry. I think there is going to be times where he will come off the bench. And if they need a result, I think they will rely on Muller. However, if they already have the results that they need from France and from Portugal, I can see him starting off the bench and giving, especially Jonas Hofmann and Musiala a game. There has to be room for improvisation. There has to be room for flexibility. It's been a very long season for a lot of these players. It depends on the formation. In that 4-2-3-1, I can definitely see Muller starting.
Musiala, as you say, has been a big story in Germany and in England over his decision to opt to represent Germany at senior level. England fans are aware of him in terms of his performances in the Bundesliga and in flashes in the Champions League for Bayern. He's massively, massively highly rated. And despite the fact that there is this glut of talent, particularly out wide and in attacking positions for Löw, Musiala is still likely to have some sort of an impact. Can you see him squeezing into the starting 11, or do you think it will be a case of if they need a goal or if they need a bit of a spark, he's an option to bring on?
Definitely the latter. I was personally surprised he was in the squad. I thought he might have gone for the younger Florian Wirtz just because of Wirtz's responsibility to the Bayer Leverkusen team. A lot more minutes, a lot more consistency. Musiala hasn't gotten all the game time in the world, although he has put in a definite shift for the Bayern team, especially, in, as you said, in the Champions League against PSG in the second leg. So it's definitely the latter where they are struggling with ideas and they need someone to maybe have an impact, definitely an impact sub about him. I honestly thought as well, because of Jogi Löw's kind of bringing back the old guard to just try and secure his legacy instead of developing young talent is another reason on why he wouldn't have picked Musiala. But yeah, he is in the team. He's a fantastic talent, but I don't see him starting unless they get two wins from two and they start him in the Hungary game just because.
It's one of the most tired stereotypes in international football that you can't write off Germany in a major tournament, but the numbers do back it up, and that will be a source of positivity for Löw, as you said, as he chases this legacy this summer and when he leaves the German national side. And since 2004, runners-up in 2008, and then back-to-back semi-finals in 2012 and then 2016 in France. This is a difficult group. It's been labelled a group of death. We know Portugal are defending European champions and France are defending world champions, but Germany, as you say, given the fact that there is the option for best third place, will be confident of, at the very least, getting out of the group. But it's impossible to, again, I'm going to go back to the cliche, it is impossible to write them off with that huge amount of talent and now some really experienced figures coming back in. This might actually play in Germany's favour because there's so much focus and so much pressure on France and Portugal that Germany can just quietly get on with their job of powering on. Where do you see them ending up? Do you think they could go all the way to the final? Do you think potentially that the spirit is back within the camp?
Yeah, I think the spirit, and they'll want to give Yogi Löw a good send-off. He has been there for over a decade. He has done fantastic things with the team. He has made some bad decisions. He has regretted kind of not relying on the old guard so much in the last 2 years. And I think everyone will go out and fight for him to not only secure his legacy, but also their own. I think they can easily make semi-finals. I think some of the performances of the recent past have been maybe a little bit too critical. World Cup winners never do well the next tournament, so I'm willing to write off the World Cup. They've had a lot of changes, a lot of injuries. So, yeah, I think it would be silly with the amount of talent, the amount of good form that they have in that team to write them off.
I agree. I think, again, I'm going to say it for the third time, and it is a cliche, but sometimes cliches are true. You cannot write off Germany, and particularly with Löw looking to sign off with a big, big tournament win. Jasmine, thanks so much for your time and your thoughts on the German national team.
Thank you.
Great stuff. And that completes our Group F preview podcast. Thanks so much for listening.